Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis. What's going on?
Oh, lots. We have a tremendous guest joining us in the next segment of the show, Gail Green, who is one of the most influential restaurant critics in the world. She had the for New York Magazine. She reported on restaurants all over the world in New York from 1968 to 2000. She was the insatiable critic, and when we were just young restaurant pups, we would always read Gail Green. It was the New York Times and Gail Green were the only one that mattered. She has written a new book called Insatiable, Tales from a Life of Delicious Excess, and it's about sex and food. And it's really cool. She slept with Elvis and Clint Eastwood.
That's a pretty big deal.
And who else did she sleep with?
Burt Reynolds,
of course. That's very cool. Anyway, she writes about the whole, it's a whole history of, like, it's a memoir. And it's a beautiful memoir of a very important foodie. And it's an awesome, awesome book.
And she's going to be with us today. And we're very excited about that.
But in the meantime, we have more banal things to talk about. There's a great article that I read that touches on a subject that I remember years ago we talked about. We were never fans of what we call architectural food or altitude food. And at the height of the altitude food...
I get it. Height of the altitude food.
Nice. Nice. Unintentional, but nice. At the height of altitude food, you know, food that you have to sort of knock over to eat. You know, I never liked that. It was very fashionable.
Or you had to deconstruct.
Yeah.
It wasn't necessarily that it was just high. You had to take it apart.
I don't want to take apart my entree. Right. I just want to dig right in there. But in the 80s, that was very... fashionable, and it's still fashionable in some quarters. Gotham Bar and Grill is where it started. But was never into that. And at its height and at its most silly, people would put things on the plate that were sort of decoration that were inedible. We were always against that. We always said, listen, if it's on the plate, you should be able to eat it.
I remember working in a place where there was an ice sculpture with sea beans in it.
Oh, yeah, that frozen into the sea beans.
The sea beans were frozen into the ice sculpture, and the oysters were laid on top of the ice sculpture. And people would try and pick at the sea beans in the ice sculpture and try and get to them and eat them. Yeah.
Don't do that.
Leave that
alone.
That's a frozen sea bean. You don't want to eat that.
It's a sea bean frozen in ice. It's just to make it pretty. And we had one chef interviewer once. You remember this guy? We had a very tall shot glass.
Oh,
they were,
I remember him.
3.5 inches tall, and they're very narrow and very small and very cylindrical. And he had, in a cooking interview, cooked for us some crazy contraption of, like, the Eiffel Tower of tuna he made.
Yeah, it was tuna. That was it.
And he supported it all with this shot glass. I'm like, don't put a glass on my plate. It might break. Right. And what you had to do to eat it was take the shot glass out of the center, which meant the Eiffel Tower fell apart.
Well, you had to pick the tuna off, and you could do that with your fork and your knife, or you could do that with your hands, I guess, if you needed to.
And then you had a, like, greasy little shot glass of sauce that you're supposed to pour over the top.
Greasy shot glass.
It was a beautiful photograph, as long as you didn't try and eat it.
You're the chef. Pour my sauce.
Yeah, right, exactly. Okay. Well, there was an article in Time Out New York that talks about sort of a similar topic came in recently about people who... the title of the article is called Don't Eat That, Diners Beware, Cleaning Your Plate May Be Harmful to Your Palate. Dan Tritoot liked the butternut squash soup at the Israeli-themed Miriam in Park Slope so much that he thought he might as well try to eat the salt mound soup that the bowl was sitting on. Don't eat that.
Except, sir, that's a mound of salt.
That's just there for... yeah, don't eat that. Okay. One patron at Heirloom, which is a great, fairly new restaurant on Orchard Street in Manhattan.
Vegetarian restaurant.
Reportedly attempted to consume the little black stone that's designed to weigh down the check on the credit card tray. I guess you could think it was a piece of chocolate, but...
And, sir, if you don't have a gizzard, don't eat stones. Okay?
Yeah, he was stopped by a waiter. That's really good.
Don't eat that.
I'm just so... As a restaurateur, I'm like, that is such a liability. Someone is going to break $5,000 worth of teeth.
Somebody's going to break a very expensive tooth.
Okay, here's another one. This one I think they should have been able to figure out. A similar don't tell me you just ate that moment occurred. That's funny, I like timeout. At Moss on Downing Street, to decorate a squab dish baked in clay, Chef Galen Zamara thought it would be nice to add a piece of brown clay to the plate. In the right light and with a few drinks, diners found themselves chowing down on a hardened nugget of pottery. That's okay. Important to get your minerals.
And you better change your restaurant lighting. Okay, because I want to know if there's any clay on my plate.
Here's one that's really out of line. Really out of line. At Sushi Samba, they have a conceptual flourish that they call spiced aromatics with the Kobe a la plancha appetizer.
Yeah.
When the plate arrives, diners see a glass filled with hot broth and various spices. And that's it's just in part smell.
It's aromatics. And this has become kind of very popular to bring aromatics into a dish. And what some people will do is they'll kind of put them in a bolt like a plate underneath and a flat plate underneath. And
my favorite thing that I ever saw was there was a chef a long time ago who would, he sent out venison or something and he wanted to infuse it with the sense of pine. Mm-hmm. And what he would do is pine cones smolder, the pine tar smolders, and he would stick a pine cone in the grill until it started to smolder and then put it on the plate and then put like a cloche over the top of it, you know, one of those mm-hmm, plate mm-hmm. toppers. And so he had a big round cloche over the top of it and he'd bring it over to the diner with the pine cone smoldering under it, and he would remove the cloche, and it would you'd have smoke, and you'd have this wonderful piney essence that was great. But
except every once in a while, the pine cone would catch on fire, and you'd be sitting there going,
no, no. Actually, but the thing is, look, if you put a pine cone on my plate,
right.
I think you have a reasonable expectation that I will know not to eat the pine cone. If you put a glass of broth with spices in it on my plate, I'm going to think it's the sauce.
Of course you are. Of course you are. And like I said, a lot of people are trying to get those aromatics up into the dish.
But,
and they're putting out something either under your dish or something that you can't really get
but
to.
But you as the restaurateur need to, or the chef, need to make sure that it's clear what it is that you're doing. Yeah. And so at this place, at Sushi Samba, somebody gets this glass of sauce, they take their sushi, and they dip it in it. And the waiter comes over and says, "What are you doing?
Right.
You can't do that." I don't know where the French accent comes from.
Francis.
I don't know why the waiter in the sushi restaurant has a French accent.
My guess is at Sushi Samba, the waiter does not talk like this.
I know, he talks like a college kid from NYU. Is probably what he talks like. But I'm sorry, you shouldn't put something that you can't eat on the plate. And if you do, if you have to put something on the plate that you can't eat, make sure it's something that no one's going to mistake and eat, or you're going to be on the hook for a lot of dentistry.
And if you have to do that, your waiters need to explain it. Your waiters just have to explain that what's going on the plate and that there's something inedible on the plate.
At Bow 111, the owner Chris Johnson has watched a few diners attempt to eat the lemongrass stalk that function as skewers. Johnson's own brother once made the mistake. If your chef's brother makes a mistake, you know you've really got a problem.
Well, at least lemongrass is edible. Okay, it's terrible, but at least it's edible.
Chewing on hay.
It's like chewing on a piece of bamboo.
Well, but
okay, for anybody who hasn't actually had a piece of lemongrass, think of chewing on a piece of bamboo. That's what eating a piece of lemongrass
is. Our guest when we come back from the break is going to be Gail Green. She was the insatiable critic for New York Magazine for very long. Her new book, I read it last night through and through, really tremendous. We'll be talking with Gail Green in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Catherine Lombardi and Stage Left Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. And today our guest is Gail Green. Gail Green was the longtime restaurant critic for the New York Magazine. Her column was The Insatiable Critic from 1968 to 2000. It was one of the most important restaurant columns in America, and it was very important to Mark and my formation as foodies. And her book is called Insatiable, Tales from a Life of Delicious Excess. Gail, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Gail, so nice to have you here today.
It's wonderful to be with two restaurant guys and foodies, because I was one before the word was invented.
You know, I got to tell you something, Gail, I'll be honest with you. We have a research assistant who sort of goes through and makes abstracts of books for us and highlights things.
Uh-huh.
And at about 10 o'clock last night, I sat down thinking that I was going to read the highlights. Read the whole book till 4 in the morning.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, this is one of those books that you can't just page through. You needed to read it.
Oh, well, that's fabulous. I want everyone to know that.
Well, we're going to link you all out there in listener land to our website where you can go and pick up a copy of Insatiable by Gail Green at restaurantguysradio.com. So, Gail, this is a memoir. This is a personal memoir, but it also really tracks like the awakening of the American restaurant scene and the American palate and American cuisine. Which is it more? Is it your personal memoir, or is it about food?
Well, I think it's about those incredible 40 years when America was falling in love with food, just discovering food, and what I did in between meals.
And what you did in between meals.
I was just lucky to be working for New York Magazine at that time when magazines were really important and everybody read New York Magazine, and I was thrown into a spotlight as the person who was discovering food and passing along ideas on how to handle the haughty maitre d' and wine lists where you didn't know the language, and all of New York who were beginning to be affluent and caring about food sort of followed along after me.
Gail, Mark and I graduated high school in 1983, and we started working in the restaurant business in 85, 86, and we opened our first place in 92. And for those of you who don't know, we were crazy foodies from, you know, when we were just consuming and working our way through college.
I was a crazy foodie at 7 years old.
Thinking that we would eventually get out of this business. We have yet to extract ourselves, but, you know. But
addictive, isn't it?
It is
crazy.
Indeed.
But it was to the only reviews that mattered through the 80s and into the 90s were Gail Green and the New York Times. I mean, now other voices became ascendant. What was it prior to that? I mean, in the 60s and 70s, were there many voices as there are now?
Well, it was very scary to be the voice that was competing with Craig Claiborne, who was the revered critic of the New York Times, and that was pretty much it.
Mm-hmm.
There was a critic in the Gourmet that always only wrote nice things,
mm-hmm.
and didn't count that much. But it was all eyes on me when I started. I had no credential, and Craig Claiborne had huge credential. I thought they're going to discover me out to reveal me for the amateur that I am. But it was amateur in the real sense of the word. I loved food, and I loved eating out. And I was a foodie long before anyone else caught on.
And as a counterpoint to the Times, you were not just, there was the criticism of the Times was they only reviewed French restaurants above 14th Street, you know, and you sort of went everywhere in Manhattan.
Well, actually, I followed Craig's lead because he did go everywhere,
mm-hmm.
even though he much loved the fancy French restaurants and was much more at home in them than I. He would go downtown to a little Spanish restaurant in the village and make them warm the plates. I was very impressed. So, of course, yes, I thought, number one, I wanted to describe restaurants in such a way that people who might not be able to afford to go there would feel like they'd eaten there anyway, and also to discover places that everybody could go to.
So, Gail, you say you had no credentials. How did you get into this then?
Well,
how did
I was
you,
a newspaper
fall into
reporter.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, and I loved food, and I was running around eating with my then husband, spending however many hours it took to get to the next great restaurant in America and in New York especially, but also in France. We were, you know, quite nuts. You had to go to France at that time to have a real culinary epiphany. And so we went to France twice a year as soon as we discovered that.
If you're not willing to drive at least 10 hours or take a plane ride to a culinary destination, you're not a foodie.
You're definitely not a foodie. A foodie will go to any length.
You know, I remember reading one of my favorite things that I ever read was in Calvin Trillin in the Tummy Trilogies. He wrote that as he traveled across America looking for the great American food, he would invariably find himself in some small town covering one story or another, and the mayor of the town would know that, you know, this great food writer was there, or the chairman of the Chamber of Commerce would greet him at the airport and say, "Mr. Trillin, we're so glad you have come, you know, and this would be the 70s, and they'd say, we have a wonderful French restaurant in town." And he said he was always tempted to say, "No, you don't."
Well, of course, in those days it was true. They didn't.
But I mean, the whole kind of finding of the American cuisine, of the local cuisine, that's sort of new. I mean, I think that you talked about how to have a cultural epiphany, to have a culinary epiphany, you had to go to France in that time. But
there were no great American chefs. The mm-hmm. greatest American restaurant in New York at that time
mm-hmm.
was the Four Seasons, and the chef was Swiss.
Mm-hmm.
No one had a clue who was cooking at the Coach House, which was a American restaurant much loved by Craig Claiborne and James Beard and ultimately by me.
Uh-huh.
But then along came Larry Forgione and Patrick Clark, and they came out of the Culinary Institute of America. They were in the tiny first classes that really counted. They went to France, or they were working in French restaurants in New York, and suddenly the American chef began to be a real force, and that changed. There was a period when you didn't need to go to France at all, that more was happening in New York, as I think it is right this minute. I think New York is the great place to eat in the world.
You know, it's funny. The one thing that I want to say about this book is it is a personal memoir, but it's a personal memoir. It's inextricably tied with the birth of the American cuisine and the New York and the American restaurant scene, because it's the birth it's a memoir of someone who had a seat at the table.
I mean, your timing was actually perfect.
Oh, right. I was so lucky to have come along at that moment, as I call it, the moment between the pill and the plague. Suddenly, if your son announced that was not going to Harvard, but he wanted to go to the Culinary Institute of America, you didn't have to commit suicide. You say, okay.
Maybe you should talk to my mom.
Our guest is Gail Green. Her book is Insatiable, and we're going to be talking more with her in just a moment about Tales from the Life of Delicious Excess so far. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Kathleen showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagut and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. You see, Kathleen Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or KatherineLombardi.com.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left in Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant, and our guest today is Gail Green. She was the longtime restaurant critic for New York Magazine, and her new memoir, Insatiable Tales from a Life of Delicious Success, is what we're talking about today, and you can pick that up on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. You know, Gail, we were talking before about how you sort of became the other voice that mattered in New York. It was the Times and New York Magazine under you.
Well, by the end of the 70s, you had an incredible phenomenon, and that was lawyers and marine biologists and businessmen who had been quite successful or were bored with their field becoming chefs and mm-hmm. opening restaurants. And it was the beginning of incredible great American chefs in New York. It was the period of Chanterelle mm-hmm. in Soho with David Waltuck and his wife. He'd been a marine biologist. He decided he could cook. He traveled to France, picked up some few ideas, and came back and opened an extraordinary restaurant on Grand Street.
And boy, could he.
Yeah.
And Barry yeah. Wine. Yeah. Barry and Susan Wine. They had a little restaurant in New Paltz that they opened because she had a shop and they wanted a place for people to come and have tea and cookies or whatever and stay right in the neighborhood of the shop. And they cooked out of Julia Child's cookbook. That's all they knew. She made bread. He used the cookbook, and they got so good and so full of the glorious things that were going on in France, they decided to move to New York on Second Avenue around the corner from Lutèce.
And how did you find out? Where was your position? I mean, you're a journalist reporting on this emerging thing. How do you find out what goes on? How did you stay so in the know?
Well, first of all, walking everywhere, up and down the street, seeing what was happening. It was the beginning also of food press agents, so you would get some releases. Gossip. Oh, foodies, being oral personalities, are very into gossip.
Mm-hmm.
So I would keep track of everything that way. And the Underground Gourmet at New York Magazine basically covered the very inexpensive restaurants, but they kept me in touch with what was going on, too.
Well, when we come back, I want to talk about the fact that while your name wasn't in the press very much because you were the press, you know, when we talk about food celebrity, what I realize when reading this book is you were the first contemporary food celebrity. And, boy, I'd love to have lived your life so far, and I'm curious as to what's happening in the future. Our guest is Gail Green. Her book is Insatiable, Tales of a Life of Delicious Excess, and we'll be talking more with her in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Gail Green is our guest today. She is a very well-known restaurant critic and food writer. Her longtime column, The Insatiable Critic in New York Magazine, was one of the most important columns in the history of the emergence of contemporary American cuisine. Mark and I read it every time it came out. Her book, Insatiable, Tales from a Life of Delicious Excess, is a memoir, and you can pick it up by going to our website at restaurantguysradio.com.
So, Gail, before the break, we were talking about the fact that you were the first food celebrity, the first true food celebrity. In your book, you're tied to names like Bert and Clint and Elvis. Those are some pretty serious names to be tied to.
Well, actually, Elvis came long before I ever even thought that much about restaurants and what I could do. Reviewing was never a dream or even a possibility. I was just out of college. And Elvis came to Detroit to do two shows at the Olympic Stadium, and I was madly in love with Elvis. So I arranged to cover the show and was flirted with one of the Memphis Mafia who accompanied him and got invited back to the hotel between shows. So when Elvis came in and looked around his suite with all his friends reading the funny papers, I was the only female there. So he.
And my guess is you weren't reading the funny papers.
I was stunned watching him across the room, coming right up to me, putting his knee between mine and saying, "Who are you?" Before I could answer, he took my hand and led me into the bedroom.
I love that.
I thought to myself, I'm going to just go with this.
Can I tell you
something? The reason I think this is a food event is because at the end, when I tell that story, all I remember the most vividly is that he asked me to order him a fried egg sandwich for room service. And I think that I really remember the fried egg sandwich more than how it was. What it looked like meant I was destined to be a restaurant critic.
Well, you know, it's funny because, all right, that was a brush with celebrity there. But then you go on and have, through food and through the restaurants, you've, you know, across the continent, two different continents, really led a life dealing with food luminaries. And maybe it wasn't in the public spotlight, but, you know, it's sort of what we all imagine a food celebrity does today. Well, you think you're the first of a kind to do that?
Well, it was a very small and incestuous world. And if you had the influence of writing a restaurant column as powerful as New York Magazine's, you were destined to meet some of the great, great chefs in France. They wanted to be included. It meant a lot.
Mm-hmm.
When Americans started traveling and carrying the magazine to Switzerland and to France, driving around the truffle fields the way I did, using my magazine as a kind of a menu to order from.
What?
So, yes, not only the restaurant world was looking for me and wanting to meet me, but early foodies wanted me to come to their homes for dinner and drink their great wines.
I got letters
from women saying, would I take their husbands to lunch for his birthday? I mean, it was amazing.
Did you do stuff like that? Would you? I mean, like for a reader or something like that? Would that ever happen?
No, but I did do auction items for charities
where
I would take people to dinner
or
arrange for caviar at Cartier, and then where they could try on diamonds and dinner afterwards as an auction item.
That's great.
Well, I'll tell you, Gail, I started reading the book and being a little jealous of you, and by the end of the book, I was a little jealous of Burt Reynolds.
Now, you know, it's interesting. Burt Reynolds, you don't usually think that a very handsome a man, much in demand, ladies man, would be an incredible lover. Usually they would be very sort of selfish and full of themselves. And he was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
That was a wonderful memory.
You know this book. And
not
really,
exactly foodie, though.
Well, but who cares? It was Burt Reynolds.
Said,
you know what I mean?
Burt Reynolds said, "Let's give dinner."
Do you know what I have to? Now there's a rule, and I'm sure that you know this isn't covered in your book. But my friends and I have a rule. Like if there's an attractive woman, right, sitting at a table, or you meet in a bar, or you hear her talking to your friends, and she's a 7, but she's a foodie, she's an 8. And if she's a foodie who knows about 9, she's like a 9.5. You get like 2.5 points for that. If you're Burt Reynolds, you're already 11. You know what I mean? You cannot like food and still be a 10. Would you agree with that?
Right. That, absolutely. It was that was just an incredible experience. But imagine canceling a reservation in a 3-star restaurant in Paris.
Oh, is that?
I was a little bit shocked, but then I thought, okay.
Did that hurt you very much?
Quite wonderful.
But to cancel the reservation with a 3-star restaurant in Paris,
in order to stay with
Burt Reynolds in his hotel room, I think there are a lot of people that would view that as a difficult choice, but would have made the one that you made anyway.
I thought he had good priorities.
Now, you know, the thing about this book is it's a lot of fun. Like your reviews are, it's a lot of fun. I love some of your chapter titles, like Splendor in the Foie Gras and Bonfire of the Foodies.
Well, that was your period. The 80s was when you became restaurateurs?
Mm-hmm. We built our first place in 92, but we started working in the business in 86.
Well, that's the period of restaurant madness when everybody wanted to be in the restaurant business, and many of them did try it, and many of them failed. It was an incredible time for grand cafes with elaborate architectural schemes and lots of places being built in the photo district of New York City.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And many of them lasting less than a year, even if they got great reviews.
Yeah.
Very fickle crowd. They would just follow from one place to the next. And if you didn't have something to keep the neighborhood coming, you were finished.
Mm-hmm. It's not just that. I think that people also who get into the restaurant business, especially when you come from different businesses, they treat it as a toy instead of a business. And there's got to be some mixture of art and business in the restaurant business.
Well, you have to really learn the lesson. And I think somebody like the owners of Gotham Bar and Grill, who started in the business because they thought it would be fun to have a party every night, discovered it wasn't a party every night, but they did learn, and they went on to develop Bolo and Mesa Grill and Bar American, and have had extraordinary success with Gotham. But there's a chef who never leaves his restaurant, unlike the celebrity chefs who are flying all over the world now opening new restaurants.
Right. He actually was supposedly considering a deal in Philadelphia and then backed out and said, no, I'm staying in New York. You know, he was going to do both. He was going to be, you know, Philadelphia's
not
that far.
Well, he was a restaurant consultant to Stripe Bass.
Right.
And he said the chef there was very good, very talented.
Yeah, we had him on the show, and we're dying to go down and have a little dinner there with him as well.
Oh, you should. I love the Gotham Bar and Grill. Mm-hmm. It's one of my favorites.
You know, you talked just a moment ago a little bit about celebrity chefs and, you know, how that's kind of come to the fore. Is that something you embrace, or you think that maybe we were better off in times of yore?
Well, for them, it's wonderful. They're making a fortune. And they are familiar to a huge audience. They sell their cookbooks like crazy. But I think that it's partly a loss for us. Mm-hmm. I want to go into a restaurant and see the chefs. Either through the open kitchen or when he passes through the dining room. It really makes a big difference to me when I'm in a very important restaurant to know that the chef is there, or to feel that the food I'm eating is the same as if the chef were there. It's not always so.
I think sometimes what we're getting is a derivative of the head chef or the chef, the celebrity chef's food, rather than that celebrity chef's actual
food.
Yeah,
that's what I'm feeling too. I remember when Danielle of Café Boulud and Danielle, the, you know, really wonderful French chef and very serious, said he would never own a restaurant he couldn't reach on his bicycle, which was before he opened in Las Vegas and Palm Beach.
He evidently has a very fast bicycle.
I guess he's the E.T. of the restaurant
It's a very fast-flying bicycle. Our guest today is Gail Green. Her book is called Insatiable. It's a memoir, and a delicious memoir, a tales from a life of delicious success. She was the longtime food critic for New York Magazine, and her articles were instrumental to Mark and my understanding of food, and we'll be talking more with her in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey 1450. The time is 11:45. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants and also of The Restaurant Guys radio show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. Today we are talking with Gail Green. It's a great honor for us to be talking with Gail Green because when we were just little restaurant pups, we read Gail Green and she taught us all about food by reading her articles. In reading this book, you talk a lot about the early Gail Green when I was like, you know, a kid. And you came onto the New York restaurant scene, and it strikes me that the articles that you wrote, especially for the time, were kind of irreverent. And I'm going to quote from your book a little bit, if you don't mind. Articles like how to melt the glacial sommelier, how not to be humiliated in a snob restaurant. One, I urge the genetically insecure to number one, write a bestseller, get named a correspondence in a fancy divorce case, change your first name to Prince, or greet the maitre d' by name. This is my favorite. Greet the maitre d' by name so that he's thrown off balance, struggling to know why he doesn't remember yours.
Well, in the beginning, I was just nobody going to these very haughty restaurants and being humiliated. And that's how I looked at them. I wanted to find a way to master the situation so that I could go in and get a good table. You know, at one time in the most fancy French restaurant, La Grenouille, they did not serve cookies to the poor people sitting in the back room, which they called the ketchup room. They only served cookies to their pets in the front room. It was designed to make you feel inadequate. And I figured the readers, many of them would have the same experience, and I wanted to help them be able to conquer these haughty people at the door and have a great food experience in the French restaurants, which at that time were the most important restaurants in New York.
Do you think that kind of culture in restaurants has changed? Do you think that restaurants are now trying to be more user-friendly?
Well, certainly the few French restaurants that are left have finally translated the menus into English.
Uh-huh. That helps.
And they retired some of those old tuxedos and are trying to look more accessible. You have some snobbery, which is very similar. You know, restaurants that don't take reservations, but when Calvin Klein or whoever they consider to be an important person walks in the door, they immediately get a table.
Mm-hmm.
There's a secret number to call.
Yeah.
I'm so lucky I have some of those secret numbers.
I always think,
you know, are we going to be attacked as we walk in front of all these people who've been waiting?
I think a lot of people would kill for your little black book there, Gail.
for multiple reasons.
With all those secret numbers in there, I think that'll be...
I probably will not include that in my next chapter of my memoir.
Well, I think it was great, though, that you wrote from the everyman perspective. And I always liked that about your writing. And I always remember when Ruth Reichel wrote that first article, the review of Le Cirque. Did you remember that?
Where she gave it one star for the normal restaurant and three stars if you happen to be known.
Right, because she went there twice unrecognized and in the middle of her second experience got recognized. And I'll always remember what she said. Siri McConey said to her when she had arrived twice unknown and was sort of thrown in a corner and made to wait forever once they lost her reservation. And then the third time she arrived 15 minutes early and said, "Oh, I'll wait at the bar." And Siri McConey himself came over and said, "Madame, the King of Spain is waiting at the bar, but your table is ready."
The one thing I loved when we had Ruth on the show is she said, "The King of Spain really was waiting at the bar."
That is such a serial story.
Oh.
He is such a snob, and when you tell him that there's the poor people suffering out in the back of the room where he never goes, he doesn't believe it. He thinks everyone is equal in his restaurant while he does this incredible dance for anybody that he cares about.
Well, you talk in your book about some when you spoke to these restaurateurs in the 60s and 70s and brought up the no cookie for the peon policy, they defended that policy, did they not?
Oh, yes.
Did they not?
Little old lady from Kalamazoo. When I can have the social lions of New York City, I don't care.
So did you make that a mission to sort of fight that? I mean,
they had a few recessions in between, you know, in all this history in the 40 years when restaurants learned they had to woo customers.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's a kind of, there's a certain amount of arrogance about who gets a table and how difficult it is in the hottest new restaurant. And the prices are so high and starting a restaurant costs so much money.
Right.
It's just a different world now.
But do you think that once you get there, people are treated more equally in the dining rooms?
Yes, I think that's true. They're treated more equally in the dining room, but they're not necessarily treated more equally in who can get a table at 8:30.
Yeah, yeah.
Versus who can get one at 6 or 10.
Well, you know, I remember a number of restaurant critics whom I respected, Bill Grimes being one of them and Brian Miller also being one of them, had been interviewed when they stopped reviewing. Both of those gentlemen, and Ruth Reichel to a certain extent as well, talked about how, you know, it had been a great ride, but they were really done with it. I mean, there was so much. You were eating out all the time, and it was so hard to stay in shape and to stay focused, and it was sort of all-consuming. I don't get that from you.
Mark and Francis, I absolutely love that, and I'm still living it. I still go out 8 nights a week.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
I'm always looking for the next great new restaurant. I do a column in New York Magazine based on first tastes of some of the restaurants that have been opening. It's still very thrilling and fun for me. It's not fun to eat 4 awful meals in a row, and it's not fun to have the future financial future of some guy who's put $5 million into a restaurant in your hands,
right,
as they do at the Times. But I firmly believe that on my deathbed, I will still be doing this, and my last words will be, "Bring on dessert."
Gail, I'll tell you, there is nothing in the world to this day, almost nothing in the world to this day that I love going out, love more than going out to dinner.
Well, how about staying home for great sex?
That's, well, that was the thing.
That would be the one thing.
That would be
would
the
like
one
more.
Thing.
Excuse me, but
cherry
pie.
I would actually like to have my cherry pie too.
I like going out to dinner, having cherry pie, then coming home and letting the evening take its course. I mean,
well, of course, I always recommended making love first.
Oh, I like that.
Well, then you're not full.
After a great dinner, I thought the definition of a great dinner was that you couldn't possibly make love after.
Well, you know what? And that's what Sundays are for, everyone. So our guest today is Gail Green. Her book is Insatiable, Tales from a Life of Delicious Excess, and we'll be talking more with her in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is Gail Green. Her memoir is Insatiable, and it chronicles her 32 years as the New York Magazine restaurant columnist, and very important column. Now, Gail, you knew everybody in the American food scene, and it wasn't all just about the wonderful and fabulous. You were instrumental in starting City Meals on Wheels, which is a pretty important charity. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, yes. I read 25 years ago, I read a little item in the New York Times about how the city was scrimping to feed the aged, and they had no meals at all on weekends and holidays. it just seemed like I could not live the life I lived, and people would be without meals on my street. So I called James Beard, and I said, you know, let's fill some Christmas baskets for these people. And he said, well, let's work on getting weekend meals. So we raised $35,000 that weekend on the phone and brought Christmas dinner to 6,000 people. And we discovered that it was a huge project to begin to deliver even just Saturday meals. But we organized and became an official charity, City Meals on Wheels. And in those 25 years, we have raised, I think, almost $200 million. And
wow.
We are now delivering 2.2 million meals a year to 17,000 homebound elderly New Yorkers who can't get out to cook or shop for themselves anymore. And it's just an incredible feeling. It sort of seized me and obsessed me in the same way that for a while I was obsessed with Burt Reynolds. The same passion into raising money, and incredible people came along and joined our board, and we have a fabulous executive director in an office where they actually act as if all those people are their grandparents.
I love it.
It's very rewarding.
And that was you and James Beard that started that.
James Beard and a couple of other people from the food world.
That's incredible.
That first weekend.
It's such a great organization. You should be very proud.
I want to read with you still on the air because I love this. And it was a review of your book where someone said, and now Gail Green lifts the lid on her most provocative subject yet, herself. And oh, what a pot of feu it is. I think that's beautifully apt. And I'm going to recommend that everyone go and buy your book. And if you're ever out in Central Jersey and hungry, you have to come and have dinner with us.
Oh, I would love that. Gail, I'm listening to your commercials here, and it sounds like I need to come visit.
They're working, Mark. They're working. Gail Green wants to come.
Very compelling.
You've been delightful, Gail. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This was fun.
Take care. For us as well. That was Gail Green. The book is Insatiable Tales from a Life of Delicious Exodus, of Delicious Excess. She's one of the most important food writers to have been a journalist to be writing about food for the last 40 years. You got to buy it. Check it out on restaurantguysradio.com. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.